extra time is exactly how I find out what's going on in the MLS.
Get lost. Get lost.
Maybe this podcast has influenced me a little bit as well.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
That's why he's here.
Oh, from New York, New York. You are listening to Extra Time, Club and Country, driven by Continental Tire from AT&T. 5G Virtual Studios, I'm Andrew Weavy with my partners in soccer. Another late one here, folks. Late-ish, Matt Doyle, David Goss. Wants us to get going. He's got a trip to the mountains.
I'm fine. I'm actually excited this game's a little earlier, so Doyle won't just melt down on us again.
Kaylee Carr
might have his legs in him.
Well, hey, you know what? Happily, my anniversary came on a away day in CONCACAF. We're back, though, for victories. 2-1. It was a little bit nervous at times. It was certainly nervous in the first win.
That would be like you to skip the tough away day. Come back.
I'm a little, my hands are a little soft for that. Don't have the calluses there. So you guys go put in that hard work. I'll do the easy
You had a good excuse. You had a good
easy-ish
excuse.
Easy-ish stuff. Costa Rica. An old Costa Rica. We heard about that a lot in the night. Maybe the best moment of the night was Kendall Waston, Bolaños, and Sabo coming at the same time. They couldn't save the Ticos. But this early goal almost did it. I mean, Doyle, this was a nerve-wracking game to start. It got better. It got better. There were more good elements, let's just say, in this one than we've seen in a little while, I think.
There were. I mean, the U.S. actually, I thought, played a pretty decent first half, other than the, the opening minute. And then maybe 5 minutes around the 30, the half hour mark or so, but they were able to get runners forward, create overloads out wide. That's how they created this first goal. They were able to play pretty comfortably through the Costa Rican midfield. It was very nice to see, but also Costa Rica played a mid block 4-4-2 with no real destroyer. Yeltsin Tejada and Kelsey Borges were two of the best midfielders in CONCACAF 6 years ago. They're past it now. This game ended up being, I think, encouraging, and obviously 3 points is great, but it was more interesting than it needed to be from the U.S. And maybe that's just part and parcel of having such a young team out there, because literally the field players were a U-23 team. Like, this team that played out there for the U.S., that could have been the Olympic team if we had made the Olympics. So I think there's going to be a lot
most important competition in men's international.
I'm still upset about that. You gave me a
You
flashback.
Should be, Weeby. All you got was three World Cup qualifying points.
In my backyard, raking leaves, just furious still.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if we had made that, then we would know that James Sands is the ideal backup, number six for Tyler Adams and stuff like that. But anyway, we're digressing. It was a good result. I think at times it was a good performance. It can get better. It needs to get better with Mexico paying a visit a month from now.
Kaylin, you seem to like the one-word review. I wonder if you have your word.
Oh, dang. I have it when you don't do it, and then when you do it. I would say the response. The response from the away match and disappointing loss at Panama, and then the response to the early goal. And, there was pressure on this team coming into the match. That seemed to, compound within the first minute. I thought they took a pretty positive slant to the game, including the play that they actually got hurt on, where they're very aggressive. Stefan comes in and makes a play off his line. And I think that kind of comes down to, we'll get into some of the choices or not, but I think that comes down to a little bit of that continuity or newness, where players looked a little surprised to see him there, and then just kind of didn't really recover from there. But the team sure did. And I give a lot of credit throughout the roster, but I would sort of single out Timothy Weah as well, who found out 5 minutes before the match that he was going to be starting. I'm sure he was disappointed to not be involved from the start, but then ended up getting his chance and took his chance well. There was an interesting wrinkle with him and Brendan Aaronson, who were very much more fluid as far as their positions go. They seemed to interchange a lot more from wing to wing, which caused Costa Rica some problems. And then a moment of quality from Dest, where you see, goodness, what he's able to do. I think one of you guys put in the group chat, like, oh, that's why he's here. And I was like, no, that's
why he's here.
I was like, that's why he's there at Barcelona. And, you know, it was nice to see him produce with the men's national team. Seemed like a big moment for him, too, and a weight off his chest. He's taken a lot of criticism from the U.S. men's national team fans and media, and I think rightly so. I've been a part of it. But to get sort of that on the right side of things and a hugely important 3 points at home was big for him and the side.
Keep the big picture, Dave. Yeah, get it in here. We'll go specifics after that.
I'd say quality. And people keep saying, oh, this team's so good. Look at where these players play. But I've kind of kept saying, and to Doyle's point from before, like, they're young. And a lot of these players don't even play a full 90 minutes. A lot of these guys don't even start. Timothy Weah has 2 starts this week for the U.S. men's national team. He started 4 games this year for Lille. Like, this isn't really the roles for a lot of these guys. And they're learning, and they will learn it. But they can do things like those 2 goals. Mm-hmm. Sergiño Dest's left-footed goal, and the way Timothy Weah hits that shot, first time, the power he puts on it, those are world-class moments. Those are moments we didn't always have a lot of in the U.S. men's national team over the past, but they were good at other things. This team's going to learn the other things and is learning the other things, but they are capable of these moments that I don't know that we've ever seen. And you come out of a game like this, and it's like, that's what you get when you have players like this. They can just pop up and create world-class moments. And yeah, there's tactical stuff that allows those openings and whatnot, but you just roll the ball out there every once in a while and a really good player is going to do a really good thing.
More to discuss in this one. We're doing this thing live right now. If you're watching our channels, Facebook, Twitter, the app, and whatsoccer.com, whatever.
We'd like to live announce that Fabian Coto just got fired from Honduras and Theodore Whitman really? Just got a new contract. the door and they're up 2-0.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my gosh. Well, that is. There are many moments to choose from tonight around CONCACAF. It has been an entertaining night for sure. Here's where the standings are right now. Mexico are going to play El Salvador here in a second as we do this live. U.S. and Mexico on top with 11 points each. That's 5 games for Mexico played. They could be up to 14 at the end of the night, or they could stick at 11 or get to 12, TBD. Canada at 10. Those are your top 3 spots of the auto qualification to the 2022 World Cup right now. Panama. Resurgent, but did not get the job done because, by the way, I said Canada at 10. They worked him at BMO. Big-time win. 4-1 win for John Herdman and the boys. Panama still at 8. They had a big one at home against the U.S., of course, the week after this. And then Costa Rica, El Salvador, Honduras, and Jamaica rounded out, although Jamaica, I guess, did just jump up into that 5-point spot. So it gets a little tight there at the back. We're going to talk about it all.
There's separation, yeah.
Yeah, but we're going to talk about it all. And then if you're watching live, just know that we're going to have MLS 2222 presented by Body Armor. All the stuff looking ahead to the weekend on the podcast. So go subscribe, go rate, do what you got to do. Let's dive into it. Let's start with the lineup choices. Just sort of the basis for this one. Zach Steffen in goal, Paul Areola. Only one of those lasted. Paul Areola did not. Had a groin issue, I believe they said, and had to come out. We had talked about in the Twitter spaces, like, oh my God, why is Paul Areola starting his 3rd straight game? Well, the body didn't stand up to warm-ups, so that didn't work out. But Tim Weah certainly did. That was nice to see him come in. It was a lot of people what they wanted. But Zach Steffen, what did you think of that decision, Doyle, pregame, and what do you think of it now?
I thought it was the wrong decision. I thought it cost the U.S. a goal. I'm glad that the U.S. got away with it. But it's shot-stopping is the most important skill a keeper has. And Zach Steffen should have saved this goal. I mean, the TIFO's still up. Good Lord. He should have saved his goal. And I think Matt Turner would have.
You think the issue in this moment is he should have saved it rather than he never should have come off his line from the start and started the moment that created it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to blame him for that because you have Zach Steffen out there specifically for that moment. Now, he should have, like, He's a modern keeper. He's a sweeper keeper. Yada, yada, yada. Well, then he's going to come out and try to head balls away like that. And to be clear, he didn't really have to. But I'm not at all surprised that he did. His headed clearance was poor. Sergiño Dest, his headed clearance attempt after Steffen's was poor. Tim Weah did not follow through on his tackle. If you want to look at little moments, if it's Paul Areola there, he is crushing Brian Ruiz out of bounds into touch, not letting him back heel flick that up the line for Moderita. So that, like, these are the little moments in personnel decision making that can lead up to big things, which is you know, giving up a goal that you shouldn't have and being down 1-0 early. But the U.S. got away with it. I guess this means it's open as to who starts next month against Mexico.
Is that the message that's being sent? I guess we might find out here as we do this thing, and you know, Greg Berhalter's press conference starts to trickle out.
I don't believe that's what it is.
It doesn't felt like it didn't. I don't know. Maybe I'm just. I don't. You don't start right, a guy five times and then.
This is a must-win home qualifier.
Yeah, which didn't make a ton of sense.
But it, unless Greg Berhalter still sees it as Zach Steffen as his number one.
Yeah, I think it's clear that he favors. I think it is the case. I think he favors Zach Steffen. I think he always has for a number of reasons. And I don't think that there was enough of a reason to take Turner out of the lineup. He had a couple shaky moments on crosses in Panama, but seemed to kind of dig himself out of it. And when there were mistakes, he was able to kind of find a way to, even when he played the ball with his feet and it was a poor clearance, it came down his throat. He makes a good save to keep it clean at that point. Now, on the other side, I think the reason why Greg prefers Zach Steffen is because of exactly those things, that he's better with the ball at his feet and he's better coming off his line. And ironically, that's what got him into trouble tonight, was him coming off the line. Now, I actually agree with this sense of Steffen being the I think he will end up getting this number one spot position, because I think he does suit the system in the way that the team likes to play and can come off the line. But I didn't agree with the decision to put him in this specific match, where I say if he's your number one, play him for a match day one, and then you can't travel. Maybe you play Turner game two, you feel good about that, and then you go back to your number one at the end. Because what happens is, in the first minute, the players are not used to him coming off, having a goalkeeper going 30 yards out and heading balls, where if that's not a part of your system and that's not a part of your play, that can throw you off guard. And from there, you're chasing. And that's exactly what happened on the play. I don't really fault him for not saving the one at the end, partly because there's a player right in front of him. It's very hard. But I also made me wonder if Turner gets that one. And that's part of the questions that's going to be asked. And I think it's only going to open up more goalkeeper controversy as far as who is the number one, especially leading into this next match against Mexico. But I think ultimately Greg does favor Steffen, and I think it's partly because of the reasons he got in trouble today. And I think with time, maybe that sorts itself out. I think Zach has close to the shot stopping ability as Turner, but I think he gives you a little something more as far as, we talk about verticality all week just ad nauseum, but I think that also exists as far as center backs going backwards. And we saw that tonight from both of our center backs and what they can do as far as covering ground, even though it was against sometimes 39-year-old, you know, attacking midfielders who are trying to go in on breakaways. But it also exists as far as goalkeepers who can stretch the field this way. It just seemed to throw the team off because they weren't expecting for it. And it was right at the beginning of the match.
So I think it's fair for you to say that Greg Berhalter probably favors Zach Steffen and what he can bring to this team. I wouldn't say that a goalkeeping battle is a controversy, because you can say, and you can easily come out of this and say, I've got two starting goalkeepers. That's the reality of the U.S. men's national team, is I've got two of them, and I want them both to be involved in this group, because I never know who's going to be healthy, and I never know who I'm going to need or who's going to be in form. And so I think it's fair for Greg Berhalter to say, and in his mind, I've got six games to open up. Zach Steffen wasn't available for some of them. Matt Turner played and played well. Zach Steffen gets a game. There's a reason he plays at Manchester City. There's a reason he's been successful in his career. There's a reason he was a starter for the U.S. men's national team. And I think it's fair to have that thought process and put him in there, as well as keeping him connected to the camp, keeping him connected to the group and as a part of this. And yes, the reason is that Greg Berhalter wants him to be Matt Turner plus the things Zach Steffen can do. If he can put him in games and he's making saves like Turner, then he's getting what he wants on the ball as well.
But how many national teams across the world rotate their goalkeepers?
It's not a lot.
How many national teams across the world start a U23 team in a World Cup qualifier?
The U.S. rotated Tim Howard and Brad Guzan last time, and that worked out great. So there you go.
Understood.
I think part of the reason you don't do it is not because the players don't have quality or that both aren't good enough. I remember back in the day, there was the controversy between it was Keller and Friedel,
and then it was Keller and Howard.
Right. And you know, it's a tough one because especially when the goalkeepers bring you different qualities, it'd be one thing if they were both very similar type goalkeepers, which I think in the past for the US pool, maybe outside of Howard, it was a little bit more similar. So you could kind of ride on form. But when you play with players, goalkeepers that fundamentally change your system and the way you play, I think that becomes a much tougher task. I think we saw that tonight.
But isn't that the point that, one, you play with a completely new back four? So it's not like you can say, oh, well, when we were in Panama 3 days ago, it was like this, and now it's changed. They all should have been training together for the last week, preparing for this. The other is, wasn't the system today different than it was 3 days ago? Like, aren't you changing based on opponent and based off what you're trying to do in each game? A home game is different than an away game. So I don't know that a goalkeeper has to be different.
I actually think not really. I think if the U.S. had just played, like, there was very little difference between the formation that Costa Rica played with tonight compared to what Panama did. There's very little difference in terms of the line of confrontation. The difference in intensity was there.
And personnel.
Yeah, but like
but the personnel I think is the difference.
I don't think the U.S. tried to do anything specifically different in terms of the system in this game compared to Panama. I will say Panama did end up pressing a little bit higher, and they pressed with two, and they were able to control the U.S. build out a little bit more than Costa Rica were able to tonight. And part of that is. You might be right, road game, but part of that is that the U.S. were just flat against Panama, and I don't think they were, other than the first 60 seconds, I don't think they were flat tonight. They were a little overeager, they were a little sloppy, but they were intense. They were up for it, and that was nice to see.
I do wonder about what goes on for Mexico. This is a big question mark, Stefan or Turner. When I think about it, I'm like, what could Stefan have done? And this goes back to what you say, Kalen, which is that there's just a preference here. So say Greg sees a preference.
What Stefan?
Yeah, because like it's not going to be like he's not going to show you in club games. He's not playing in them really.
Yeah,
they don't train much. Like, let's be honest, in a three game window in 7 days, how much high intensity training is happening? It's mostly travel and region, right? Like, so then to me that is, and like what did Matt Turner just completely biff it? No.
Well, let's be real. He did almost give up an Olympico. In the last game, that was an issue. They went for it twice because something went wrong. But again, I don't think that's the point. First of all, Zach Steffen, what he did was 6 years of a body of work, four of which under Greg Berhalter as a head coach, right? Sure. So like, again, not everything is based off what happened the last 90 minutes, and it shouldn't be. That would be too simplistic. If that's what the men's national team coaching staff is doing, that's not good enough from them. So that's all I'm saying.
I think Andrew says we should stop talking goalkeeper. Sorry.
From the player's perspective, the only thing I would say is you want to have some sort of idea as to why players are in or why players are out. And for me, I didn't understand enough of a reason to see that Turner had done enough harm or had given up, you know, a howler or whatever it was to drop him for this match. And so I was surprised to see that. And, you know, if Turner continues his good form and the Revs continue their form into the playoffs, I think he has a lot more of a platform to put pressure that he should be the number one when it comes to Mexico. Whereas that's always going to be the question with Stefan is, does he have that opportunity? Does he have that platform outside of that history or pedigree to be able to say, I'm the guy that should be number one? And I don't think he went even a step further tonight to stake, you know, hold of that claim. I think if anything, both of them should be sort of 50-50 right now.
It would be shocking if Stefan started against Mexico.
I wouldn't be shocked.
Doyle said it. This was a must-win qualifier at home and he started. Ooh. It's not like a gift. You can't give gifts in that situation, can you? The U.S. did in the first minute. Okay, so we talked about the response. Let's talk about the goal. Let's talk about Serginho Dest, a moment that we've been waiting for a long time, but the moment was preceded by buildup and a moment that helps you understand maybe why Stefan was in there. You get confused. They go back and forth. We talk about it so much. The little ball out from Stefan to help keep that thing going and the buildup, Doyle. I mean, that's the way the U.S. wanted to play. I did not think Costa Rica would be suckered up the field like that, but once they were, the legs, they just ran away from them.
Yeah, it's incredible to me that, I mean, the way Costa Rica came out, I thought it was so naive to give this U.S. team a chance to build and hit the seams and go forward in numbers the way they did on this goal. But not just on this goal, like multiple times throughout this game, the U.S. was able to just advance up the field by stringing passes together. And Costa Rica was frankly kind of lucky that Anthony Robinson and Sergiño Dest couldn't really pick the last pass as well as they might have, because this could have been a lot worse than 2-1 on their end. But that's, look, if a team gives you space to play like that, then you take the space and you punish them. And the U.S. did a nice job of building from the back. You're right. It was a lovely little chip pass to the sideline from Stefan to kind of disorganize the Costa Rican press a little bit. And then it was off to the races. I think seven players got a touch. And then good patience once they got into the final third. And look, the issue with Sergiño Dest is that defensively he's inattentive. And we saw that on the first, on the opening goal as well. Like, he runs and he tracks Montarita's run, but then he doesn't get back outside. And that's why that goal stood. But he's also, just as David said, a world-class attacking fullback. You know, like, he needs to be better defensively. I thought he was against Jamaica. I thought he was in this game other than the first minute. But it's in home games, it's worth having him out there because he can give you moments like this one, and frankly, moments like the second goal as well, which he played a big part in. And it's a trade-off that, like, I'm willing to live with it. I'm happy to see, you know, Dest getting into the final third and getting out a backpedaling defender, because he's awesome in that situation.
I would love for the standard pattern of play to be that he underlaps. It just feels like when he gets wide, the decision he makes or the quality of the cross outside of the one to Pepe for the goal, which was
he wasn't more of an, even that wide.
Right. Yeah. That was more of an inside space. It's not great from him. And I don't know if that's because he's not used to those decisions. Maybe coming through at Ajax, that's not really the pattern of play where that's where he ends up. But when he comes inside, he's so good on the ball. And as much as he wants to dribble, if the option's there, he's normally quick to get it off his feet. I think it was someone else had a shot on goal that got punched out and it came out, and Dest on his first touch lays it off to Tyler to restart the attack really quickly. It was a really good moment. And he does things like that consistently when he comes inside. When he goes outside, it's a lot of step overs and he has great feet, and sometimes he gets past the defender and sometimes he doesn't. And then it kind of seems like a hopeful ball after that. And it just feels like this is where he's good. And we saw him do it to Jamaica in a friendly as well when he came in from the left side, because he is two footed. But I'd love to see this be more a part of the purposeful play. And when you're talking about Areola and Wea, if those guys are starting and they're going to be wide, there should be space for him to come in.
For Dest, for me, it's pretty simple. I don't think he really like changed his mentality, or he had a different approach to this match, or he looked more up for it or anything like that. He kind of always plays the way he plays. He's always very loose. He's very casual. He's very confident, super technical. He's creative. He'll go behind the leg. He'll go with the step overs, whatever it might be. But at times that can kind of leave you frustrated, because you're saying, wow, that was a really cheap one to turn over. Or like, are you even aware of what the magnitude of this game is? And, but the criticism has been more that it hasn't really amounted to much. It hasn't really actually turned into goals or assists or anything that's giving us something that's worth taking the risk on the other side. And tonight was the first night where you see, wow, yeah, that's exactly, I'll take that. You know, if he can produce a moment of magic and he can produce that that final ball or that final touch, or, you know, he was dangerous. As usual, I think drawing fouls, that's a part of his game just because he's so quick and crafty. But turning that into production is super important for the team, because that changes the way people start to cover for you if you're Tyler Adams or the center backs, and saying, we've got to find this guy. And it gives him some energy and some confidence as well. So he needs to continue to get on the end of things. That's obvious. But it just tonight he was on the right side of that equation, where in other times, you know, he hasn't really been able to get that final production.
Let's go from one super club to another, from Barca to Juve. Weston McKennie, his window.
No, I thought you were going to say from Barca to Atlanta United. I'm sure you were going to talk about
you know, I wanted to. I was on the tip of my tongue. It. Yeah, in a different universe. Not so far away.
So Weston McKennie, like, he was busy and he was around the ball. And my biggest criticism of him for the longest time was that he kind of hides from the ball. Play doesn't run through him enough, which is kind of the main job of a number eight. And I think a lot of the times when he's been out there, when we haven't controlled midfield, it's literally been his fault. Tonight he was sloppy, but he always wanted it. And I like to see that from Weston McKennie, because he's another guy who I think can make special plays. He didn't really make much of them tonight. He's got to be a little bit more comfortable using his left foot to reverse play a little bit and just to open up, especially if he's going to play on the left side of that 4-3-3 with the dual eights. If he's going to be on the left side, he's got to be a little bit more comfortable with that left foot. But the game ran through him a lot. And again, even though it was sloppy, I like to see that.
I agree with you. I thought the second half from Weston McKennie is the best we've seen outside of the Nations League final, and most of that was set piece stuff.
Yeah.
And it was purely just he imposed himself on the game. He was a factor. He changed the shape of Costa Rica because they had to follow him. They had to track him. One of the things that I think is interesting is just Yunus Musa is so good on the ball. He's so dangerous on the half turn. He wants to beat defenders off that, but he wants to get to his right. And it feels like if that's the case, why not play him as the left-sided guy? Because when he does beat a defender, now you're going down the middle of the field and you're forcing a team to collapse on you and cause chaos. And there was a couple times where he had an opening to get infield from the right side, Yunus Musa did, and he still was able to work his way to his right foot and beat the defender. But it feels like if you can have a center midfielder charging through the middle of the field and forcing back lines to react, why not do it? And he stays on that right side. Musa does not float off of it. And maybe that's why Greg Berhalter has no choice. But I think it would be interesting if you swap them.
So I think part of that is probably just like Musa's 18 years old and he's primarily played as a right winger for Valencia. So keep him at least on the half of the field where he's most comfortable. And like he was part of the combo play that led to that Dest goal. But it's a good point. In either way, I mean, unless something bizarre happens, you know, it looks like Musa, McKennie, and Adams is probably the future of the U.S. midfield. There are a couple guys. Obviously, the depth chart is up in the air.
Busio Hive had a night tonight. Busio Hive is buzzing. I mean,
Busio was good going forward once he came on, but that game was there for him to push forward for sure. Like the most dangerous chance that Costa Rica had all night, other than the, you know, the goal, came when he just like did not read a 1-2 at all. And so Miles Robinson had to commit that foul.
The foul happened and Busio at that point realized that his man was
gone. I'm not even sure he had turned around at that
Busio
point.
Busio turns, he literally turns and runs to the sideline and his guy goes behind.
To be fair, it did look like his ankles mixed. Like it looked like a malfunction where he was just like,
he is a work in progress.
But the passing range and the vision is pretty incredible. And so you choose the right moments. Right,
yeah. you don't put him in moments where it did feel like a bit of a heat check. I would have gone with De La Torre, but
Berhalter did say his quotes are coming out right now that he ran into Busio's parents in the lobby of the hotel. Those parents were giving him grief for not playing Gianluca, and 3G said, "Be patient, he's going to get his opportunity." They didn't hesitate. They
for
put him
all
right
of
in.
You youth coaches out there, just know it doesn't get better. There is nothing better. You will have parents in your mentions for
the moment you thought you clawed out of hell. You get dragged right back in, huh?
I'm taking the wheel for a second. I want to ask y'all, what did you think of Chris Richards?
I thought that he, not that it's his fault, I thought he struggled on the first goal. He's not marking anyone, and Antti Robinson, because of that, comes inside of the forward.
He also lost the original header on the Calvo long ball.
So all of that I thought was a struggle. In general, I think you saw the things that he does well. Anytime the ball's around him, he's comfortable. And there was a few times, whether it was a pass from a teammate or just a loose ball, that they were awkward and he was able to settle and start playing again. I think he was a little passive to play to Tyler a lot rather than take. He would play a 4-yard ball to Tyler rather than just take space himself. But that play where he steps forward and starts the attack and is on the top of the 18 and then presses back and wins the ball so that the U.S. doesn't have transition going the other way. You saw all of those things that he can do great, but it's his first ever World Cup qualifier. And I think it was an inconsistent performance from him.
yeah, good enough performance.
I saw a lot of things I liked from him. I mean, I haven't seen him play a ton, so just seeing some of his just sort of ranginess, you know, the way that him and Miles can cover ground. There was that play where I think he had made a run forward and then they lose possession and then the ball begins to sort of cycle to the other side and he kind of leaves his spot and just casually wins it back, which was very impressive. And he looked very comfortable on the ball as well too, which is something that you know, you hear a lot about him and it just his quality. I thought even some of those small passes where he kind of trusted Tyler and was able to play some of those short passes were good because it means you're also comfortable getting it back. I think he'll probably grow with that in time. And, you know, there was that one moment where him and Miles play some of the square ball and then that's the chance that led to the, I guess, pseudo breakaway, although he didn't make it to the 18. It was one of those
speed away.
He at least tried to shoot it.
I feel like the minute he won that ball, he was like, oh no. Like, I'm just right away, you're just like, oh, that's far.
And it's like a kick return in football when they watch the screen to see if anyone's chasing them so they know if they have to keep running.
It was like a defensive lineman who had picked up a fumble. Yeah. It was a struggle.
And can I just say, for Richards, by the way, on the penalty kick claim, he does get in there and makes the tackle. He doesn't get the ball. I didn't think there was any space to even make a tackle there, and he makes the attempt. So yeah, I don't know, credit to him.
But I chalk up the one with him and Miles on there with just like a lack of familiarity, where it was a little bit of a dangerous square ball, but a pass you can make. But they recovered and they got it done. But I would like to see that partnership again.
Against Mexico.
I think Mexico is Miles and Walker. That would be my guess. I don't know if Brooks is healthy and has played. Maybe that changes it. But I think for that game, that's the group that it's the safest group. They've played together a little bit, but it just feels like that's the pick.
But you might want to save Walker for the second game because that's at Jamaica. That's Shamar. So
don't do this. Don't do the save for the second.
But you got two games in the window. Right,
like
So it's and he just went
squad rotation is not as
two.
Yeah, squad rotation is not as important six. In the next window. Yeah.
But
Walker Zimmerman would pay to play both those games after his injury and thinking he was out of this team. But let's be real, he is loving every he came on the field as a sub and just starts yelling at people.
Well, it's a good. I would say of this window, sort of looking back, a guy who wasn't even in the initial team, he may have made up the most ground of anybody. In the pool as far as being able to now say, oh, yeah, we're having the conversation that he's probably the starter against Mexico in World Cup qualifier. That's a huge step forward for a guy that was not even called up initially for this team.
Before we talk Canada, look ahead to Mexico, all that good stuff. What'd you think of the front three? Aronson, Wea, and Ricardo Pepi.
Pepi found chances, man. Like there's a certain amount of skepticism about him out there in the analytics community because his non-penalty expected goals is not great for FC Dallas. But to me, that's more a function of FC Dallas not being great at chances rather than Pepi not being great at finding chances. And if you look at, he had three more good looks in this game from like 6 to 12 yards out. He didn't finish him, but that's okay. As long as my number nine is getting in there and finding chances, I'm pretty happy with that. That said, I thought Taylor Twellman made a good point on the broadcast about like anytime I noticed, especially with Anthony Robinson on the left, anytime he was getting forward and putting, you know, whipping a ball in, Pepi, Wea, Aronson were all kind of making the same run. There wasn't enough diversity in that. There wasn't enough misdirection. I don't know if that's a function of these guys being so young and in Aronson's case not being sort of a natural goal scorer or whether it's just a function of them not having played together enough. But I would hope that as these games go on, they become a little bit more refined in how they vary what they're doing and give those fullbacks more targets to aim at when they do get forward.
With Aronson, by the way, a little bit off this, but I think you see it with Tyler as well. The nature of the way the U.S. doesn't counter press like they do with their clubs, I think changes the passes they play and the way they play in possession. I think you see different decisions and like hesitation at moments where with their club, it's like play it so that we can lose it and go win it back. And that's a whole different world than what they're dealing with here. And I think you see it with Tyler a bunch. And I think you see it with Aronson every once in a while. Or like the one where Aronson made a near post run and lets the ball run through because he expects someone's coming behind him. His pattern of play there is different than what everyone else is doing, which, to Doyle and Taylor's point, was going to the back post as fast as humanly possible.
Yeah, I think you have to remember, obviously, Christian and Gio have not been involved. And the idea that Pepe is going to get a chance to run out with those guys is very exciting. I think when you think about some of their qualities and the way that they're going to be able to create chances and draw attention and slip balls in the box and find him in good areas, I feel like that's going to be just the prospect of that is exciting. And then Brennan Aronson is a guy where you're like, I don't know. This window, you'd say, well, without Christian or without Gio, what does this look like? Who steps up? Who can actually be a consistent threat? Who can get goals? And yes, Brennan had sort of began to prove that, but you're also saying, I don't know if he can do that without those guys or without everybody around, and can he carry some of the load? And I thought he picked up a lot of that. He was one of the most consistently dangerous threats within the team. And I think a guy that can actually push Christian and push Gio, which is a good thing for both of those guys.
With Aronson, Weah, Pulisic, and Reyna, and now Jordan Morris is back this weekend, I don't think we're going to have to worry much about the winger depth chart going forward. Like it should be a source of strength.
And Weah really impressed me too. Weah impressed me too, because off the bench against Jamaica, he was very good. Came in, shows you what a game changer he can be in that role. Game two, I was disappointed because I was hoping he was going to kind of continue that form, but with seven changes in the team, I sort of felt like it just wasn't a good situation for him, where you saw tonight more with a first choice team where you know exactly what Anthony Robinson's going to do. You understand his movement. He also, when he was on the right-hand side, had some really nice combination play with Dest, where, Goss, to your point, when Dest sort of underlaps and comes inside, Weah totally understands how to fill that space and make those darting runs in behind, created a couple dangerous opportunities like that, and then ends up getting on the goal. I think Keylor Navas probably saves that, but still, put your shot on frame and see what happens. And that's a part of the experience too, is understanding they've made a change at halftime and you need to test the goalkeeper. He didn't take a touch. He didn't hesitate. And so I think he earned a lot of trust as well this window, where you say if you need him from the start, he can. But he's surely a name where we've seen even in the past this summer, coming off the bench, he can be a big threat for us.
So I'm just putting it out there. I'm going to be heartbroken when Aronson doesn't start versus Mexico in a month. Because I think with the full team, if Gio and Pulisic are there, I don't think he starts.
It's a huge if with Gio. I think it was just reported today in the German press that it could be like another 3 weeks. So okay. I would be surprised if Gio starts that game.
So then I'm going to be happy. Well, not happy, because I don't want Gio to be hurt.
Not rooting against him.
Hey, it's a mixed bag here. Let's take a big picture, and then we'll hit Canada. Big picture for the U.S. First six games of 14 in the Octagon. Third round of World Cup qualifying in CONCACAF. Top three spot, got to get it. That is the bare minimum expectation. Straight up, that's what it is. We're there right now, tied with Mexico, who I believe, they just kicked off against El Salvador? Yeah. Yep.
It's actually not a soccer game. It's actually purely just an electrical plant, because the energy in the Cuscat Lawn right now, if we found a way to bottle this, you'd never have to have power anywhere else. That should be my company.
Solamente vibe.
Trademark. No one take that. Everyone stop listening. Yeah. Cuscat Lawn energy. Here it is.
And then it's Panama and the others that we've listed below. Costa Rica, El Salvador, Jamaica, and Honduras. All of them kind of packed in from 8-5. Then Honduras really having a tough go here. They're at 3 with a -8 goal differential. Were the first six games, these first two windows, six? What was it for Greg Berhalter? Was it a success? Was it, I don't know. How do you grade his first six games in World Cup qualifying, Doyle? Should we be happy where we are? Or should we look at this and say,
shouldn't be happy. Shouldn't be throwing yourself out the window. I think the unequivocal best thing about what has happened in these first six games is that so many players have gotten onto the field and have gotten that World Cup qualifying debut, and even away World Cup qualifying debut, out of their system or like into their ledger, right? Like once they have that box checked, it's a little easier to trust them and you could ask a little bit more. So I think you could be happy with that. I'm happy to see us playing a 4-3-3 every game. I do think it is the best way to line this team up, both in the short and the long term. So I'm glad to see a lot of the tinkering has stopped. I am not happy with, I mean, the team comes out flat game after game after game. The team comes out flat. And even as we've praised these guys tonight, there were so many times, especially in the first 50 minutes or so, Weah would, you know, the ball would come out to Weah and he would kill the momentum of the movement because he's clearly thinking of what comes next instead of just getting into the flow state. And again, maybe that's lack of time with the team. Maybe it's, you know, just his overall youth. As David said, he's only started four games all year for Lille, so he's not used to such a big role. But there was a lot of that to go around with this team. And I think some of that has to end up on the coach. Like, if the team is coming out flat every single game, part of that is your fault. So I'm not thrilled with that. And frankly, given that we've had the easiest, like one of the easiest schedules in the Ocho, I am a little worried going forward. I don't, you know, there's separation to be found right now in the standings, but that might be a little bit of a mirage. I still think the U.S. are going to qualify, and I think they should play better, but should isn't will. And then, you know, as we learned last time, there are pitfalls all over CONCACAF, and the U.S. has got to be careful not to step in one.
Really, yeah, I mean, it sums it up for me. Yeah, no, it sums it up for me. Like, look, we should be in a better position, I think, given all the time, all the preparations that were made, and all the emphasis that was put on those, the victories this summer. It just sort of seemed like, I don't know, the ideas and continuity of that sort of, we had to start over a little bit, it felt like to me.
I don't know, you'd want them to have one more point?
No,
points in the first window was the job they were supposed to do.
I think the way that they played in that first window, those first two games, two and a half games, set the U.S. back a little bit. I think they should have come out.
But not from a standings point
of view. I think they should have come out with two more points again. I mean, we did not seriously trouble that El Salvador team from open play until the final 20 minutes of the game. And that was, I think the team was flat and Berhalter probably overthought it a bit. Obviously, everything went wrong against Panama. So, like, that would create real separation. I would rather the team had played better. Yeah, that is the stance that I'm going to take. That is the hill I'm dying upon.
The only thing I'll say, if you're looking on the positive side, is I think we have seen some players emerge into positions that you feel better about. Most for me is Ricardo Pepi, especially from this window, where you're saying for the longest time you're saying, where is the number nine productivity coming from? Where is what is the future of this position? How does this project forward? And I think you found that. I do think there's been some. I think Greg has made some mistakes as far as the lineup decisions, personnel particularly, and you know, just I harped on it last game as far as Tyler Adams not playing. But you see again tonight, and we went through that midfield, but Tyler Adams just changes this team. And I think you just realize when we'll get to Canada in a second, but there's just some players you have to play. You just have to play them however long, give it what you have, and just how important he is to this team. And I think there are certain players like that, and Tyler is one of them. I actually think Pepe's one of them now too, that you just have to be in the team. Miles Robinson, I would probably add to that list right now. And so I hope that there's some learning as far as that mistake of going down to Panama and making seven changes and just what that does to a team. And I would say it learned the lesson today, but then I was also concerned about the change in goalkeeper, which just I still didn't really make sense to me. And so I just worry a little bit about some of the tinkering within the team. I understand that's a part of it, but picking and choosing when are the right times to do it and how and when to do it and how that affects the team, I think was troubling and plays into the slow first halves. But ultimately, the thing that's given me hope is that they have found responses. They have mostly made changes that have brought us back into games and then come back from behind like tonight and won them. So this team is learning still. But I think, yeah, it's somewhere in between for me.
How hopeful are you? One word answers here. How about this game in Cincinnati? This is built for chaos, baby. In that building, nothing but chaos. Mm-hmm. You feel good about it, yes or no?
I feel good. I think partly based on what's happened this summer, the U.S. team has a bit of a psychological advantage over Mexico right now. And the pressure factor as well with Tata right now is massive as well. And I think for the U.S. team coming and getting this result tonight helps to kind of calm some of the talk that's going around. Where is this team going? How does this all look? And so I think if you put your first team out there and if we get guys healthy, I'm going to feel pretty confident going against this Mexico team.
There's your yes.
Moderately.
Moderately. Yeah. Hopeful, but ready for pain. That's how I generally feel ahead of these. But no pain at BMO tonight. You're talking about plugging in Cuscatlan? Boy, the Canadian fans had themselves an amazing night. 4-1 winners against Panama. You have been talking about this for a while, Doyle. If you play your first 11 in the first two games of these windows, you're more than likely going to get smacked. Panama got smacked. But it was about as perfect as it can go in sort of the imagery with the little tussle with Alphonso Davies' goal, with Tejan having the majestic, just towering header, and then Jonathan David finishing it off to get a 4-1 at home to put yourself in position. It sort of looks like, Dave, our resident Canadian candidate. Oh boy, I'm struggling here. I figured that out. It feels like those are the top three teams. And for Canada to be in that spot, despite some blemishes of their own, and getting this win, that's got to feel like a great conclusion to this first six games.
By Canada, you mean the vibes only national team? Is that the
is it vibes only? Is that what they're on right now?
That's what they're on right now. And it was epic. I think it was Tejan's goal. Fonzie just turns around and starts like air guitaring to the crowd. Like, doesn't even. He's just in pure bliss in that moment.
He's a Rush fan? Do you think he was air guitaring something from
Arcade Fire? I think it's Arcade Fire.
Arcade Fire? No, probably. Arcade Fire is in Montreal. This game was in Toronto.
For sure, but he's not from either of those places, and you were naming a Canadian band.
Yeah, what's a good Ottawa?
They were playing in Toronto.
Is Avril Lavigne like Ottawa? Like, what comes out of Ottawa? I don't know.
He's from Edmonton. He's not from Ottawa. Jonathan David is from Ottawa.
Central Canadian cities, man.
Oof. Whoa, Weeby, really, really spreading the love right now.
As a Midwesterner, I can't believe it.
Yeah, I can barely keep track of what cities we got around here. They're all the same.
but this was huge, and I think we talk about Berhalter, you talk about the starts, you talk about overthinking and the decisions. John Herdman did it in the first game of the entire World Cup qualifying. He went with a different lineup than what they had gotten settled into because he, I guess, was going to blow the doors off. And they went behind against Honduras. They had to battle their way back. All they got was a draw. It felt like in this game as well. I think from what I could see, it was like a 4-4-2 with Alphonso Davies playing as a second forward and Richie Lai playing as left back and David Wotherspoon put in as a central attacking midfielder. And you have been so good in what you've been doing. Why change things? And you have some injuries. Kyle Larin's not available. So, okay, there's pieces you have to fix, but you had your three center backs available. You had Eustaquio, who you just rest, Tejan Buchanan, who you had just rest. It just felt like, roll it out there and let's roll. Let's go. And they didn't. But similar to what we talked about with the U.S., I think you're looking at young players coming together and learning what these moments take, what this opposition is like. And you saw a Canada team that had the confidence they would get back. And they created chances immediately. It looked like they had a penalty kick, but they never really wavered. And they just kept pushing and pushing. And what I said with Dest and Wea of world-class moments because of the quality, Alphonso Davies is the best player in the region. And it was a 1-1 game, and it should have been. Canada should have already been ahead. And then Alphonso Davies just blows the doors off by himself. It's a 40-yard run to get to a ball that looks like it's dead, but he knows he can get there. Then he gets there. Cummings is like, yeah, forget that. I'm not running. No chance. He cuts in field, and then he uses his hips to throw the goalkeeper off and pulls it back across and rolls it in. And it's kind of John Herdman. His job now is to just do enough to stay out of the way so that guys like Alphonso Davies and Tejan Buchanan and Steven Eustaquio can win games for you because they're capable of that. And from that goal on, Panama was just waiting for the final whistle. They were begging.
Panama was shattered after 60 minutes, right? Because they put everything into this window and everything into this game. It was 10 of the players who played in the first two games got the start in this one, and you knew they weren't going to last past the hour. And to have it happen on a play like this, where, you know, a world-class player gets a little bit lucky, because I thought that ball was, you know, into touch. I thought it was out of play, but like, you play to the whistle and he makes play like this. Like, okay, if you're Panama, you're like, okay, you take your loss. There are no more games at Canada for them in this, you know, this qualifying cycle. They're in a good enough spot. I mean, they're fourth right now. Their goal differential isn't great. Like, if you look at the top three, there is starting to be some separation with the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, and Panama, I think, are clear fourth place right now.
That separation will change next window because they'll all play each other.
Yeah, Mexico goes to the U.S., then goes to Canada. Right. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
If you see the ball running out of bounds, you might just pick it out next time if you feel it.
Put it into Rosie.
You might rethink that.
But it was... I thought it was all harder than it needed to be for Canada, and I think that's largely because Herdman overthought it again. And it was weird to see him do that after getting it so right so often since the Honduras game. And it was like, it didn't need to be what it was.
I agree with you completely. We have to mention that he brought on Sam Adekube like 3 minutes before the goal and shifted Richie into midfield.
Yep.
And Richie has the assist on Tejan's goal from that midfield attacking spot. And from that moment on was when Canada dominated. So while he got it wrong, and he got it wrong in that first game, he made changes in both, which, okay, you'd rather that than nothing. But like you said, he made it harder than he had to. I think overall, his decision to go for it in Mexico trust that his team could get the job done at Jamaica and home to Panama was vindicated. So overall, he handled the window well, and it wasn't easy because he called in Laren, Cavallini, and Atiba, and they never were fit. So they wasted three international, I don't know why I just said international rosters.
Their Dam and Tam is absolutely...
Where is the allocation on this thing?
Incorrectly.
They needed Jonathan David to play every minute, and he did. And he wasn't great, I don't think, this window, but he was good enough.
This was his best game, though.
This was his better have been. I mean, again, Canada was absolutely shattered. Let me ask you guys this. Is Canada making the World Cup?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like it.
It feels like it. And I think one of the things that popped out to me is Sam, stage goal, so it's a rumor, not a report. Or maybe Paul, then it's a report, said when they were in Panama and they asked people what they thought about that game and the team coming into the USA game, everyone was like, well, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada will qualify, but we think we have a shot at fourth place. Yeah. Like, I think everyone thinks they're there. And they can play on the road because they can play against the ball. They're learning how to play at home. But even against Mexico, they can play against the ball at home probably as well. It just feels like all the pieces have come together at a time when Costa Rica has fallen apart. Let's be real. And Jamaica hasn't put anything together. El Salvador punch above their weight, and they're fun. And I don't know how anyone could not root for them, but you are looking at a situation where if you can outlast an okay Panama group, you can make it to the World Cup.
Well, you saw what they did tonight, too. And I think, you know, Herdman did. Tejan did rest the second match, though, right? He didn't start.
He was suspended for yellow cards.
Okay.
Didn't they say they wanted a yellow card? They were trying to get a yellow card. Him and Larea, they're like one of those two guys in game one needed to get a yellow. I don't know.
No, but just look at talent.
Don't believe coaches and what they say. Just ask those in Miami.
Just look at top end talent on this team, right? If you go through the line, I think Goss said it, and I think, you know, it's pretty clear the best individual talent in the region with Alphonso Davies, and you go through the list of the players in their attack, especially as far as like where they play, what their skill set is, their talent. They just overwhelm teams, and they can, like you said, they can play in a different way. They've gone to Mexico, they've gone to the U.S., they've gotten points. The other difference too, and we saw this tonight also, is just that kind of personality of this team, where every time I would look down, I was watching on the double screen, like, you know, we all were, and I was looking down and just seeing everyone in the corner, the whole team with the bench clearing. I feel like I've seen that from this Canada team all summer. Like, that's just been happening all summer. It wasn't just a one-off because Panama got it riled up. Like, this team is ready for that always. And I think that they just kind of have that personality part too, where maybe in the past, I'm not sure I would always say that about the Canada teams, where you would say, oh, well, the result's going against them, or do they have the toughness of the, or the experience, or the, you know, the kind of experience, whether it's for the club side or where they're playing with their club team, or do they have the top end talent? They kind of have all of those things right now, timing and the right way. So I feel like they're not just a World Cup. I mean, they got to qualify just like the U.S. does, just like everybody. But yeah. I feel like if you think about them at the World Cup, that'd be a fun team to watch.
Yeah, but here's the question. What's bigger, qualifying for the World Cup or becoming mainstream? Because Herdman just said in his presser, Alfonso Davies got the text. Drake hit him up.
Wow.
Drake hit him up tonight. Drake
that
says
the second
Drake
time,
wants to Drake wants to hang out with the boys tonight.
Don't let Drake on the bandwagon, guys. Come on. Like,
nice. Right?
I guess actually for Canada, OG's Canada men's only. National team, that's the only squad he's allowed to bandwagon. Like him going around, bouncing around the NBA to different courtside seats. I don't know. I can't have
no, he's a diehard University of Kentucky guy.
He senses it. He senses that World Cup berth. He's like, man, I got to get on now.
I don't know if you want that Drake blessing. Yeah, but good for Fonzie.
10 points.
Let him pick
third
up the
place
tab,
right now. Two home games. Coming up. Yeah, there you go. He's definitely good for that. That's exactly what you're looking for. Hey, tonight, Drake's got us. U.S. in first. Canada maybe going to move up. We'll see. This game is live right now against El Salvador. If you are listening live, we're going to wrap this thing up. But if you're not listening live, now you got more MLS talk coming your way. 22 under 22 presented by Body Armor. And a look ahead to the weekend. Where can you get that? On the podcast. Subscribe anywhere you get your pods. All right, we'll be back. Extra time, Club and Country, driven by Continental Tire. Next window, Mexico for the U.S. to get things starting. Canada has Mexico as well in that window. Should be very, very interesting. Hit us up with all your questions, your comments, your hot takes, 401-206-0MLS. Let's get into some MLS this weekend. A full slate, some national TV. Go check the schedule at MLSsoccer.com. But it's playoff time. Basically, we have a sprint all the way to decision day on November 7th here. Most teams have played 28 games. There's some outliers on 29, but in the thick of the playoff races in both conferences, it gets real thick. Everybody's on 28, so it's basically even footing. What is your playoff storyline to watch? What do you care about? What are you invested in? A team that's trying to make it, maybe Five Stripes, Atlanta United, a super club, as they were called early in this show. Maybe it's a team trying to hold on to playoff position. Maybe it's just the grab bag that is basically 4 through 9 in both conferences. Dave, where you at?
I don't think it gets any better than. Do you want to know? I thought we were doing that game.
Well, we know who listens.
in terms of the playoff race and what I'm most excited about, it's been really fun to watch what's happened with Vancouver and what if they can. I think as a club, take a step forward, even with the step back of letting Mark Dos Santos go, it feels like Axel Schuster has gotten his hands around the project. Ryan Gauld is legit, and there's building blocks there. They don't need to make the playoffs this year to prove that all of that is true. But if they do, what a boost it would be in the market to your fan base that's just been dying for something to cheer for. And I think what a confidence boost it would be for a lot of the guys on this team. And there's, you know, they've built this thing a few ways. Guys like Brian White and Florin Youngworth to say, MLS experience matters and you can get winning players in this league, similar to what the Colorado Rapids have done. But then they've also finally gone out and made a little bit of the investment that they've just never made. And they've sprinkled in some academy players here and there, and hopefully we'll see more going down the road. So that's the one that I've been following week in and week out, watching every game. I guess I watch all the games, so I don't know why that even matters. But I think that's one of the more interesting storylines.
It's one that you actively remembered. Yeah, I feel that. Vancouver hosting Sporting Kansas City on Sunday, 10 p.m. Eastern, MLS Live on ESPN+. This is a possible, if the Vancouver Whitecaps can somehow push their way in, it's a possible playoff matchup. You have Kansas City at 2. If Vancouver maybe gets to 7, you're seeing a trip to KC in the future if it all holds out, which we know it won't. with the way that the standings look. But Kansas City has some issues too. And if you're looking at this game, you might be wondering, what are they going to look like without Alan Pulido for the next month? Because he's going to be out for the next month. He just had surgery. Who knows? Maybe he won't be back in time and ready to go for the playoffs as well. So there's some big question marks for Kansas City. Doyle, what's your storyline? What are you watching?
I mean, I'm interested. I'm always watching all of it. But the fight for home field in the Eastern Conference is actually very – very interesting to keep an eye on because, like, okay, Nashville's probably got it in second. Philly have played really well since that disappointing loss to Club America in the CCL semis. But, like, 4 through really 8 or 9, depending on how the Hudson River Derby goes this weekend, all of those teams are in the mix to get a home field game, to get one home game to start the playoffs. Right now it's Orlando on 42 points, then DC, NYCFC, and Montreal all on 40, Atlanta on 39, and the Red Bulls on 37. It's like it's tight. It's tight. And, you know, based upon the year to date, NYCFC should be much higher in the standings than they actually are. They've played really well. They haven't finished their chances. I think DC is probably better than where they are in the standings as well. But, like, at some point, you just are what your record says you are. And what the record says for those two teams in particular, and, like, this whole group, is, like, you are middling. And now this final 3 weeks of the season, somebody's got to separate.
Kalen? You bought these middling teams, you're going to go to the top.
Well, yeah, I was going to say a lot of the attention will go in towards the scramble for these last playoff positions. And I do find those intriguing. I think the West is going to be complete mayhem down to the wire. And I think there is an opportunity for some teams that haven't been good most of the season to make a run up. Whereas I think some team in the East that's been some teams in the East that are kind of hovering around that lines that are actually, I don't know. I feel like a good team may miss out. There are some teams that are close to that line that could potentially drop down. But I'm going to be looking more towards the teams just below the very top of each conference as far as who is a sleeper team that can go deep in the playoffs. And I think a lot of that will come down to playoff positioning and home field advantage. And Doyle talked about that in the East with Nashville. I think Nashville is a team that if they can hold on to that two spot, they have caused problems for New England in the past. If they play at home, their home record is very strong. If they can hold on to that, I think they can go win a game on the road in Foxborough and get to MLS Cup and potentially host it, which would be incredible for that club. And then in the Western Conference, I'll be watching Colorado as well. I think there's a clear one. And then I think there's actually a clear two with Sporting Kansas City. And I think if Colorado can hang on to that third spot and stay right around there, get a home match, that's going to help them a lot. They went to Seattle recently and lost in a pretty bad one, but then responded in a big way this past week. So I'll be watching both of those two teams, who I still think like are a little bit under the radar in some ways. It's just because New England has been so incredible, and then you have Seattle as well and as Kansas City. So just that right below spot that I think can actually maybe make a run in the playoffs, or at least to see how they kind of round into form towards the end of the year.
I'm looking Western Conference. Who's going to just biff it? Who's going to fall on their face? And I'm looking at you, LA Galaxy and Minnesota United. As exciting as Vancouver has been, somebody's got to fall off. You know, somebody's performance has to either not match Vancouver or go down the tank. And those are the two sort of candidates in my mind. Real Salt Lake, looking at you a little bit too. But there is going to be a team that just isn't able to hack it. They just don't get it done. It happens every single year. Somebody's in position and they lose it. Who is that team going to be? I think in the Eastern Conference, it feels more natural that it would just be a shuffled deck. All these teams are pretty good. In the Western Conference, there's some teams that are ready to fold up and go home. It feels like
it was Chicago Fire last year. Was it? When RSL got in, when they didn't play on decision day, it was the Galaxy, right?
Galaxy, yeah.
Against San Jose. Galaxy.
Yeah, it was the Galaxy. It was the Galaxy losing to Houston.
Right.
Yeah.
So there is one every year. You are right.
Always. Maybe. No, there's always one. Somebody's gonna really infuriate their fan base. Let's real quick hit our game of the weekend. I'm going to get us started on this one as well. Dave panned me in the pre-meetings. He said, come on, there's no playoff stakes here. But Houston, Seattle, apparently Jordan Morris is getting himself on a plane, and he's going to be available for selection. Imagine Jordan Morris into the Seattle Sounders team. I don't know how much he can build up in a month's time. I don't know how much he needs to build up in a month's time. He probably just needs to be able to impact the game off the bench, and that could be the difference maker in a playoff, maybe MLS Cup run.
15-minute super sub, man. Like, I mean, that's just Jordan Morris as your 15-minute super sub is absurd.
Wow. Put him and Leo Chu on and just let him run. Yeah.
Just go at him. Just kill him. What are you guys watching? Give it to me quick.
I think it's obvious. Kalen.
Yeah, good. Good. That's good.
I'll say for me, it's obvious. 1 p.m. on Sunday on ESPN and ESPN Deportes. It's New York Red Bulls, NYCFC. It's a rivalry game. It's always entertaining. It means a lot. And on top of that, they are now within 3 points of each other for a playoff spot, which if we had said this when they were originally supposed to match up during right before, I think it was the All-Star game, everyone would have laughed and said no possible chance. NYCFC was going in one direction. They were going to contend for a home playoff game. The Red Bulls didn't even look like they were close. And now you're talking about the Red Bulls control their own destiny. And if they win this game, they can jump up over NYCFC. It's absurd to even think about. And so I think now, hopefully, this one has some juice to it.
They'd have to kill NYCFC like 10-0 because goal differential is second tiebreaker. But yes,
right, they would be tied on points. Enough,
just saying, they wouldn't be above it. But yeah, you know, on vibes, they certainly would be.
It would be thick, but it could happen.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you think, Doyle? What are you watching?
The Galaxy. They've won one game in the past 2.5 months. They're hosting Portland, who've been very good since that drubbing a couple months ago in against Seattle, I should say. The Galaxy are like, this is a straight up nosedive they've been in since early August, and it like looking like a death spiral. They got to figure out a way to pull out of it. Portland's a bad matchup for them, a really bad matchup. Greg Vanney teams always want to have the ball. They always want to be expansive with how they play. They give you chances to get in transition against them, and that's how Portland loves to play. So this is, man, like it's like the opposite of the Red Bulls thing we were just talking about. Like if you had said at the All-Star game, yeah, the Galaxy might miss out on the playoffs, everybody would have said, what are you talking about? This, like, they're going to contend for a home playoff spot. But they have just gone straight into the toilet, and they got to fix it fast because, look, LAFC has a home game this weekend as well. They're not out of it yet. We've talked about Vancouver. Bad stuff can happen if you go 2 months without winning a game.
Speaking of being
Galen
on the edge
seems
of the,
giddy
the
over
toilet,
the idea
yeah.
of the Galaxy going into the toilet.
Yeah.
No, I'm low-key
a
Galaxy.
Scars there.
I'm low-key a Galaxy fan. It's pain, but admiration at the same time. It's like, you know. Anyways, that got dark. Let's keep it light. I'm going to go across town, though, and say, although Goss's recommendation was good with the New York game, I actually might go to that, which would be my second MLS game in person this year, which is a record low for me by far. But I feel like now's a good time to get on that bandwagon in person, and that's a good match. But I'm interested in San Jose and LAFC. They played recently. LAFC lost to San Jose, and then they also lost to Portland, I believe, twice. Both of these teams are hovering just outside and kind of waiting for someone else to slip up, whether it's the Galaxy or Minnesota United or Real Salt Lake. I thought LAFC had figured things out. It was a crazy 3-3 match against the Galaxy and El Tráfico, and then they had this sort of explosion where they scored 4 goals against an undermanned or, sorry, red-carded Sporting Kansas City, and then we're able to get on the top of RSL, I believe, 3-2. And I was like, this is the LAFC scoring goals, like just the goal output. And then it just dried up from there. And Arango's really their only kind of like real dangerous goal threat. They have not been able to convert their chances. And they didn't match up well against San Jose, which you would have thought would have been, was traditionally a very good matchup for them. And San Jose have changed the way they play a little bit and been a little bit more practical, I guess. So I'm going to be watching that game, I think a national TV match, and kind of getting to that do or die stage, I think, for both of these teams, if they do want to kind of just stay within striking distance of the playoffs and hoping for someone slip up, because you kind of get the sense that these teams also are trending in the wrong direction, whereas the only other team that's around there, which is Vancouver, outside of trying to go toe-to-toe with Seattle, which did not work for them. They feel like more they're trending up and waiting for someone else to slip up. Oh, one note.
All right,
Charlie Candle, Vela, looked like he was – I saw photos on Instagram through my reporting, he was at practice. So that's all I saw. I just saw a photo of him at practice. I was like, okay.
Oh, man. I'm going to start saying that at home all the time. I'll be like, oh, I saw this new product I really need to buy that I've never seen before via my reporting. Yeah, that's it for us. Let's do one more before we get out of here. 2220 presented by Body Armor. If you haven't seen the list, it's at MLSsoccer.com, MLS app. Ricardo Pepi, number one, after being unranked. I don't think anybody's surprised about that one. I believe we all had him ranked last year, so blame these other voters. What did you think about Pepi, number one, Doyle, and who's your biggest snub?
I mean, he obviously earned it, right? Like, he set a record for goals by a teenager. He's done it for the U.S. national team as well. He got the blessing of David Goss, who called him the best finisher he's ever seen come out of the development.
We should make a t-shirt with that on it.
Right?
Can there be a train going by?
Yeah.
But incidentally, for what it's worth, David Goss had Ricardo Pepi ranked lower last year than I did.
So it's anyway, part of the coaching process. If you push too far too fast,
you're motivating him. I get it.
Yeah, obviously.
It's all about adaptation to 2222. If you give them too much of the start, they're not ready.
I'm bringing him along.
Slow burn.
So as for snubs, it's fun the way this list has evolved because it used to be 24 under 24, and it could be that because if you were 23 in MLS, you were still a prospect. And 5 years ago or so, that changed as more academy kids started to come through the system, as the league started to buy more good young players as well. We changed it to 22 under 22, and for a couple of years, 22 under 22 meant like prospects. Like, you were just a prospect if you were on this list. That has changed in a massive way. This year, I went through the list, and 1 through 30, every player from 1 through 30 on this list had at least 2,000 professional minutes. That includes 17-year-olds like Cade Cowell, and Moses Nyman, Justin Che. So the way to look at snubs is like, okay, who are the guys who are regulars for good teams that aren't for some reason on this list? And the two that come to mind are John Tolkien, the left back for the Red Bulls, and Josh Atencio, D-mid for the Sounders. Just in terms of being good young players who are already relatively proven professionals at such a young age. In terms of snubs as like who's just got a crazy high upside, who maybe hasn't played as much and isn't on this list, the goalkeeper for the Chicago Fire, Gabs Lunina, he's a grown man at 17.
He might be their starter next year. He's their starter right now.
I'll honestly be surprised if he's not. I actually had him on my list. I've never seen an MLS keeper. He's the youngest goalkeeper ever to start a game in MLS, ever get a win in MLS, ever get a shutout in MLS. And he's a grown man. And from everything I've heard out of the Fire, now under multiple regimes, he carries himself like a pro. He's got like that Tyler Adams thing about him where he's just kind of a killer and he's completely locked in on the game.
Who had that record?
By the way, when Bill you Hamid? Talk snubs on this.
Was it Bill before question. That? I bet it was Bill. I think he was 18.
I think it was Bill. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was 18.
Speaking of potential.
Dallas has started some young keepers too. So.
Yeah, that's true. Potential and price tags. I think there's about $30 million in 22 young money and young DP and straight up DP signings that didn't make this between like Leo Chu, Tyus Magno, Santi Rodriguez, Federico Navarro to go back to the Fire, Santiago Moreno. I mean, you're talking about big money that did not make the list. Internationals. I mean, Schoen just started against England.
Yeah.
The FC Dallas winner against England for Hungary. Marcos Lopez has played like half of the minutes available to Peru in World Cup qualifying. I mean, it's pretty incredible where this list has gone. And we may even get to a point where it's 20 under 20. Because if you look at the age ranges of so many of these guys, 19 years old, whether it be Tolkien or Atencio, all the way down to 17, 18, Mamadou Fall, barely anybody talking about him. Union screaming about Quinn Sullivan. The depth is crazy.
It doesn't even include guys like Buzio and Tanner Tasman, who would both be on this list, but were sold earlier this year. Those are another two 19-year-olds. I mean, Brian Reynolds is young enough for this list as well. Alfonso Davies is still young enough for this list. So
that's crazy.
Gives you an idea of the amount of talent that MLS has started to produce and cycle through the league, you know, into meaningful roles and then into like literally some of the best teams in the entire world.
That's decent. It's fun. Player kids. 2222 presented by Body Armor. Go over to MLSsoccer.com or the MLS app to check that out. We'll end here. AA Ron. Hit us up. What would it take for a D-mid to win MVP? Sounders can finish with 65-plus points. Best defense, best goal differential in the league. Jao Paulo is currently at 3 goals, 10 assists, at D mid, you could say box to box at times, with Heal at 3 goals, 16 assists, and a quote, much lower work rate. What if he catches Heal in goals plus assists? How would a D mid realistically win this award?
I can tell you the minimum is he would have to do more than what Joao Paulo is going to do this year because he's not going to win MVP.
Yeah, he might win.
That's your line. The line at a minimum. I mean, none of us have put him in that conversation, and there's probably a lot of bias against the position and the way that we view the game and all those things.
What do you mean none of us have put him in the conversation?
Have we?
I had him on my second of my ballot.
Okay, then Doyle
did
it.
You're surely not going to win the list. Doyle. As if your team doesn't win the supporter shield, right? Like the argument for a DP, or excuse me, for a MVP at a defensive midfield position would be that he changes the game in ways that don't always appear on the score sheet, which he does. But that has to also materialize in the performance of the team being way better than anybody else or clearly the best in the league. I think that would be the formula.
Michael Bradley should have won it in 2017. If Michael Bradley didn't win it in 2017, I doubt Joao Paulo will in 2021. But like, it's neck and neck. As far as I'm concerned, it's neck and neck with him and Carlos Heal at this point.
Yeah, I think it's three on top. It's Heal, Shell, and Joao Paulo. And I still expect Carlos Heal to be the runaway winner of this one. From all three voting parties. That's it for us. Hit us up. Let us know what you think. 401-206-0MLS. Extra time at MLSsoccer.com. We will be back on, let's check the calendar here, Monday to wrap up the MLS weekend. Enjoy your week, everybody. We'll see you then.